extent. If you brought your Bibles with you this morning, we're going to be in the book of Hebrews, chapter 3. And before we get started, I just wanted to say one of my favorite, perhaps my favorite accent in the U.S. is a Georgian accent. Because I have the best accent. I can say that because my mom is from Georgia, from Valdosta, Georgia. I can take her a lot of places, but I cannot take her to Georgia anymore. Because every time she comes to visit you all, about 4 days in, she starts talking like a Georgian. I don't know what you, do you say that? Is that a thing? And she gets it real thick. I remember I was a kid and we visited family in Valdosta, and I didn't know she was from Georgia when I was a kid, and maybe they told me, I didn't know. And we get there, and about 4 days in, she starts just getting this thick Georgian accent. And I'm like, Dad, what happened to Mom? I love the Georgian accent. The beard is a sabbatical beard. First time I've ever had a beard, I told myself I would grow it during the sabbatical, 3 months. And I said, I'm going to cut it off before camp. I don't know what to tell you other than it's growing on me. That's one of the worst jokes I'll tell this week, I hope. Actually, on a more practical note, and perhaps just as funny, I actually practically cannot cut it off because we were in California, we got a lot of sun, and the rest of my face is tan. So I can't cut it off. My wife loves it, so that's all that matters. I'd love to get the, as good as your beard, right? Yeah, the gray. I have some grays coming in, too. My wife said, don't cut the grays off, you know? She likes them. I don't know. What's that? It adds dignity. Yes, that's what we like to say. Yes. And I'm getting it in, too. Yeah, you got it. You got a lot more dignity than I do. Hebrews chapter 3. We went through a series a couple years ago at our church in Hebrews. And I was, whenever I get into a book, one of the things I try to do, because I love the Word. I've always loved the Word. Since I was a kid, we were always in the Word, in the Scriptures. And one of the things that I try to do when I come to a book or a passage, especially passages that I'm very familiar with, I try to do my best to go beyond what I call the flannel graph version of the Bible. You guys know what a flannel graph is? You guys know what that is? We used to learn it, and it's how we learned Bible stories in Sunday school. I think they were flannel. I assume they were flannel, right? They were flannel. That would be really weird if it wasn't flannel. And you just like take these little like cutouts of Bible characters and backgrounds and slap them on this. I think all of it was flannel, like the background was flannel, they stuck and everything, you told the Bible story. And I think that's phenomenal, and that's how I learned the Scriptures. But you have to remember that when you come to the Word, you've got to come to it with fresh eyes. You got to be able to come to the Word and say, God, you have something to say to me, to speak to me. And it goes beyond just a cute story, or an interesting book, or even good theology. It is speaking about the character and the nature and the person of Jesus. And so you got to get kind of beyond that. And when I went into Hebrews, we had done Hebrews and Bible quizzing, but there are a lot of things that I just didn't know about Hebrews. For example, we don't know who wrote the book of Hebrews. There is a lot of debate, and there are a lot of people who are solidly in certain camps of who wrote the book of Hebrews. Some people think that Paul wrote Hebrews. Some people think that Barnabas, somebody close to him, wrote it, or Apollos, and I'm sure there are more. But we don't know definitively who wrote the book of Hebrews. But what I do know about the book is that it is not written like a lot of the other books in the New Testament. A lot of times we think of Hebrews as a letter to a church, but you might know it actually is not a letter to a church. It is more accurately, you would say, it is a sermon that was written to the Jews and circulated to the Jews. The difference is that with a letter, Paul often wrote most of the letters, but when he would write a letter, he would either write in response to something that the church was writing or dealing with. So, for example, when you have 1 Corinthians, the Corinthian church, they wrote to Paul. Paul, in response to what the Corinthians wrote to him, he writes 1 and 2 Corinthians. And so it is a letter, and that's why it jumps around to a lot of ideas, a lot of points. One chapter you're talking about one thing, the next chapter you're talking about head coverings. And it's because Paul is responding to what they've written. That would be a letter to a church. But this is different. It's written differently. You've got to read it differently. And the moment you take that shift and realize that it's not a letter, it's not a whole bunch of ideas, you get into Hebrews and you discover the Hebrew writer is only talking about one single thing, which is awesome. And by the way, that's like good, like sermon wisdom. Every sermon should have one overall idea. There can be lots of points. There can be 3 points. There can be 50 points. That would probably be a long sermon. But as long as it always comes back to one idea. And the idea or the concept in Hebrews is that Jesus is superior to everything. He is greater than all. That's the idea. You're going to start to see that right away in chapter 1, verse 1, where you read this in verse 1. He says, "In the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in the last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir over all things, and through whom also he made the universe. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. After he provided purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty in heaven." So right away, you see that Jesus is superior to the prophets. In the past, God spoke through the prophets, and now in the last days, he speaks to us by his Son. You're also going to see this same concept develop in verse 4. He says, "So he became superior to the angels. He became as much superior to the angels as the name he has inherited is superior to theirs." So Jesus is superior to the angels. You're going to find later in chapter 3, which is where we're going to land today, in verses 1 down through verse 6, Jesus is greater than Moses. Now that one, for the Jews, would sting. Because Moses is the one who received the law. He went up on Mount Sinai, and God wrote on the tablets with his finger, and he passed the law through Moses. And they told stories about Moses. They passed the law on, and they were teachers of the law. They stewarded the law. And now Jesus, or the writer, the preacher, I call him the preacher of Hebrews, the preacher is saying that Jesus is superior to even Moses and to the law. You know, I love the language of fulfillment. I think it's language we should use when we talk about, see, because all these things that he's talking about, the angels, the prophets, and Moses, the law, the language of fulfillment does not discard those things. Even the language of superior or greater does not discard those things. It does not say that they are irrelevant or that they're wrong or that they're evil. What it does is it says that Jesus doesn't discard those things, but he takes those things and he fulfills them. He takes the Old Testament, he takes all that God spoke in the Old Testament, and he sucks it into Jesus. And so when you look at the person of Jesus, you see the law and the prophets and Moses and all of these things. So it doesn't discard these things, but Jesus now fulfills them. Like my favorite example from a good friend of mine used to say this. The idea of the ABCs. I have kids, I've mentioned, and Kira is our 4-year-old. and she's beginning to learn the ABCs, and she's really proud whenever she says the ABCs, and I'm proud of her. She'll come up to us, she'll say them. She usually misses a couple letters. It's pretty cute, and so we're working with her on it, but I'm proud of her. Why? She's a four-year-old, and she's working on her ABCs. I'm proud of that. If she was 35 years old, and she came to me and said, "Dad, I want to say my ABCs to you," and she says her ABCs, I'll still be proud of her, but I'm going to think that's weird. You know why? Because she has gone to a whole nother level where no longer is she just learning the ABCs, but now she's reading. Reading is the fulfillment of the ABCs. When you read, you don't get rid of the ABCs. You don't discard the ABCs. They're not wrong. They're not evil. In fact, they're the foundation for this. But they're sucked in to reading. When you read, you don't, almost like when you, like, did you know, like, if you were to go to a read, like, a letter, and have you ever seen these things where as long as you have the first letter of the word and the last letter of the word correct, and the word was about the same size, people can read words that are spelled incorrectly? And it's the whole idea that the ABCs, now they still are very important when it comes to words, but there's a whole nother level of reading, and Jesus is greater than, he's superior, he is the new thing that God is speaking. What God said through the prophets now is fulfilled in Jesus. That's the book of Hebrews. Now, in verse 1, this is where we want to land. In verse 1, he says this. He says, therefore, which I'm going to pause there, therefore. You know how important the word therefore is? Listen, it's been two chapters, and the preacher finally gets to the therefore. If you were reading Romans, you would have 11 chapters before finally he gets to the therefore, the whole reason I'm trying to tell you this, okay? So, in other words, why is he saying that Jesus is superior? Why is he saying he's greater than all of these other things? So, therefore, holy brothers and sisters who share in the heavenly calling, fix your thoughts on Jesus, whom we acknowledge as our apostle and our high priest. So he says a couple things. He says that Jesus is our apostle and our high priest. The idea of an apostle is someone that is stewarding the message. Or stewarding the word. There were tasks of an apostle, but primarily speaking, the apostles were the ones that stewarded the message. So they would go from place to place. They might stay in a location for a while and build a church up, but primarily what they were doing is they were stewarding the message. They were correcting false teaching because they were stewarding the word. And it's interesting that Jesus is called the apostle, because often when we think of an apostle, maybe Jesus doesn't come to mind right away. But you know that Jesus is the original apostle. Not only does Jesus steward the message, he is the message, right? He is the ultimate apostle. He doesn't just tell you truth, he is the truth. He is the way, the truth, and the life. So Jesus is he is our great apostle. He is the original apostle. So any message that is outside of the message of Jesus is not the message. And that's what the apostles were stewarding. Don't get away from Jesus. Focus on him. He's the message. The second word that's used is the priest, the high priest. And once again, there were lots of high priests in the Old Testament, but what we're seeing here is Jesus is the original high priest. And the idea of a high priest, I think, is fascinating because a high priest was a mediator, primarily, a mediator between us and God. And so the high priest would step in to the tabernacle and provide sacrifices on behalf of the people. So the high priest was a mediator. Jesus is our great mediator. He mediates between us and God. And
just a few verses prior to chapter 3, the preacher is talking about what kind of mediator Jesus is. And you'll see this in verse 14. He says, "Since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity so that by his death he might break the power of him who holds the power of death, that is the devil, thank the Lord, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. For surely it is not angels he helps, but Abraham's descendants. For this reason, he had to be made like them, fully human in every way, in order that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in service to God, and that he might make atonement of sins for the people." So the question is, what kind of high priest is Jesus? You know, he is a high priest that identifies with you in every sense of the word. He took on our weaknesses. We actually read that later in Hebrews, in chapter 4. He took on our weaknesses. In fact, I would even argue that Jesus pushes the limits on this when he has to do with like becoming like us. Because the thing is, if Jesus were to come and if he had some sort of advantage over us, if he had something like that, then we could look at Jesus and say, yeah, but it's Jesus, and so he doesn't really understand my life because he was here and, you know, I'm here. You know, when he came to walk with us, he came at our level and yet was without sin. For example, when Jesus comes, you know, he wasn't born in a really nice hospital. He was born in a manger. You know, his hometown was Nazareth. And do you remember what's said about Nazareth? Can anything good come from Nazareth? He came from a home that was a poor home. You see, because if he was born in a palace, if he had extraordinary wealth, you could look at Jesus and say, he doesn't understand my weaknesses. He doesn't understand what it's like to go through what I go through. I mean, if he was born in a palace, he just doesn't get me. That's not true, though. He was born in a manger, right? He was born in a poor family. He was born in Nazareth. He lived his life as a carpenter. So he understands what you and I go through. He understands our weakness. That's the kind of high priest that he is. He's our mediator. You know, when I think of this idea of Jesus being greater, one of the things that I believe this very firmly, but also I want to clarify what I'm going to say. So I believe in something called progressive revelation. Progressive revelation. I believe in that. Progressive revelation, I mean, it's along the lines of the fulfillment idea. Progressive revelation simply says that when Adam and Eve came and they sinned, why didn't Jesus come right then and there and die on a cross? It's a good question, isn't it? Why didn't he come and just die right then and there and just get it all over with? It's because we weren't ready for him. And so we have progressive revelation. What God is doing, and oh, by the way, in the idea of progressive revelation, actually, Dr. Joe said this morning, that in progressive revelation, it means that we believe that there wasn't plan A and then plan B. The Old Testament is not plan A, and then Jesus is not then plan B. Jesus was always plan A, and everything God does in the Old Testament and through the law is to bring us and get us to a place where we're ready for Jesus. He's always been plan A. So progressive revelation, if we've got, for example, let's say we've got Moses, because we're talking about Moses, and he's the one who received the law. And so what God does is he speaks to Moses, gives him the law, which the whole idea of the law was to show us if God were living among us, which he was through the tabernacle, how would he live? What would he do? What would he not do? That was the law. It told us who God is. And so you've got Moses, he receives the law. And so then after he receives the law, now as history progresses, it's, again, I think it's progressive revelation. God is revealing more and more. Then you get to, and we're just going to simplify it. There's a lot more history here. But now you have Elijah. And Elijah was a prophet. He was the one who often prophesied about Jesus coming. But he was the one who talked about God's plan and tried to draw God's people back to God. And so there's this sense of progressive revelation. So you, now you've got Elijah, so you had Moses, then you have Elijah, and now Elijah's proclaiming Jesus. And so then Jesus comes, and he's revealed. And then we read these passages in Hebrews where he becomes the final revelation. Now, here's the difficulty, because there's this heresy going around. I think I can call it a heresy. I know I can. Where it's not this idea of progressive revelation, it's this concept of continuing revelation. Continuing revelation is not progressive revelation. It sounds similar, but it gets off. See, continuing revelation says, similar to progressive, you start with Moses, then God is speaking more, he's getting us more ready for Jesus, so then you've got Elijah, then after Elijah, you've got Jesus. Continuing revelation then begins to say that after Jesus, God is speaking new things beyond Jesus. That's dangerous. So the idea that after Jesus, now God is speaking through the church these new things. The problem with that is it means that it's going beyond the scriptures. Now God is speaking through into the church. Now, do I believe that God is speaking through into the church? Absolutely. But in the context of the fullest revelation, and his name is Jesus. And so this idea of progressive revelation, I think, still holds its own. But Jesus is the fulfillment of that. In fact, notice in verse 3, he says, therefore, holy brothers and sisters who share in the heavenly calling, fix your thoughts on Jesus, whom we acknowledge as our apostle and high priest. The calling of the Christian, it's not complicated. I'm not saying it's easy either. But we have a call to fix our eyes on Jesus. Tab, you actually said it, because it comes up later in Hebrews. I think it was you, Tab, that Jesus is the perfecter of our faith, right? Yeah, chapter 12, right? Yep. Which we might talk about later, actually. He's the pioneer and the perfecter of our faith. In other words, he's the one who started our faith, and he's the one who perfects it, and there's nothing beyond that. Fix your thoughts on Jesus. Over the years, the many, 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 many years I've been alive. I'm 36. I have seen the church, and I've been to camps where it's almost right, where the focus is almost correct. I'm not sure there's anything that bothers me more than when I see that. I have seen people come through our church that almost have the right focus, but they're off. And my call is to look to the church. My responsibility as a pastor and as an evangelist is to look at the church and say, fix your eyes on Jesus. That's my call. And when we get distracted, you know, when the devil gets Christian people distracted, he typically doesn't get us distracted by like deep-seated sin. Now that happens. But I think a lot of times what the devil does is he just gets us distracted with good things. Things that are even right. But he makes those things the focus. A couple of years ago, I was at a camp, and I was preaching alongside someone else, and I was really struggling. I just was really struggling because it seemed like the camp, the focus over the years, has turned into this focus of miracles. And I want to clarify, I believe in miracles, and I believe God is doing miracles today. I see God do miracles today. I could tell stories. And I'll just tell one, because since Tab and I, we were at this camp, it was a couple years ago, I think, and there was this girl that came forward, and Tab was like closing up the service. I think you were singing Great is Thy Faithfulness or something like that, and this girl comes forward, and she starts like convulsing, and she kind of, her hands twist in such an odd way. I've never seen something quite like this, and as she's like doing this, there's this whole group of people that were so absolutely focused on miracles, not Jesus. In fact, the ringleader of that crew stated in the Bible study, I don't believe in Jesus, and she doesn't believe in the Trinity, and yet believes very much in miracles, wonders, and signs. Very not good. And so that whole crew came forward, and they were like screaming. Remember, it was just like a ruckus, right? And Tab, poor Tab, is trying to sing Great is Thy Faithfulness. I'm like, be quiet. This is a good song. No, I didn't say that. But after a little while, they were like screaming at this girl for like this demon to come out and all this kind of stuff. And then eventually one of the girls like turns to me. I'm over here and does one of these. And I'm like, I did one of those things where I'm like, me? You know? And so like, I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm like, I don't do this as a hobby. I'm like, what am I supposed to do? So I'm like walking up. And I remember Jesus saying to me in that moment, whatever you do, this cannot be a show. So I walked up and I prayed over this girl, and whatever she was going through, whatever was happening, after I had this very quiet prayer, only the people around could hear. And then I asked her, how does she feel? And she looks up, she releases her tension, and she yells, and she says out loud, I'm free. And apparently, she was deaf in one ear, and then her deafness, like that went away. And she was healed of that. I believe in miracles. I'm just saying that to say I believe in miracles. It's not the focus. Because I was at this camp, and I just felt like it was the focus, and I just want to proclaim Jesus is the focus. Fix our eyes on Jesus. And I remember being at the camp, and it was just that was all it was. It was miracles, wonders, and signs. The director came forward and was like, he was all excited. And he's like, you know why we're here? We're here for signs, wonders, and miracles. And I'm sitting in there saying like, no, we're not. We're here for Jesus. And I remember one of the things during some of like the healing services. And I'm a big fan of healing services. That's great. But like I remember kind of sitting back, and there's this pastor's heart in me that sees the people in the back that are sitting there wanting healing and saying things like, well, what about me? Because I'm not being healed. What about me? Have you ever thought about that in a healing service? What about the people who are not healed? What about me? And there's this passage that has formed my theology on this. John chapter 6, I mentioned it the other night. Last night. And John chapter 6 is a powerful passage where Jesus, his 2.5 years in ministry, and he's preaching, he feeds the 5,000, so he's multiplied the bread and the fish. And then after that, he's preaching to, or teaching, or speaking to the group of people, 12 to 20,000 people, pretty big church. And after he's doing that, one of the things that they're asking Jesus is they're saying, listen, we would believe in you if you just gave us a miracle. If you could show us a miracle, we'd believe you. And then they have the audacity to say, in fact, Jesus, let me give you an example of a really good miracle you should give us. If you could give us this miracle, we'd believe you. He says, our forefathers ate the manna in the desert and they had their fill. That's what the verse says, which is super ironic, isn't it? Because you know what Jesus just did? Multiplied the bread and the fish, right? And they're like, just give us a miracle. We just want a miracle. If you just give us a miracle, we'll believe you. We want the miracle. That's what we're here for. We're here for the free meal. That's what we want. And Jesus goes through this incredible passage where he says, I am the bread of life. Eat my flesh, drink my blood. Do you know what Jesus is saying? Man, this has changed my theology forever. I will never look at miracles the same way until I realize this. Jesus is looking at these Jews, and he's saying, what if I'm the miracle? What if I'm the miracle? And I started to realize, even if I never receive a miracle, he's enough. I'm going to fix my eyes on Jesus. 1 Corinthians chapter 13, if you want to follow, I'll be quick. If you want to follow, this is incredible. This is like the verse that's used, the passage that's used for like marriages, but it's also an incredible teaching on correcting the focus of miracles. And it's in chapter 13, verse 1, and he says, "If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but I have not love, I am only a resounding gong and a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and I can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have the faith that can move mountains but have not love, I am nothing." In other words, you know what really matters? It's love. In fact, he goes even further when you come down to verse 8. He says, love never fails. You know, love never fails. It never fails. It says, love never fails. But where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part, but when the completeness comes, what is in part will disappear. When I was a child, I talked like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put the childish ways behind me. You know what Jesus is saying? Miracles, wonders, and signs, prophecy, all this kind of stuff. He's not saying it's evil, he's not saying it's wrong, but what he's saying is it's temporary. Do you know there won't be healing in heaven? Because we're already going to be healed. Do you know there's not going to be prophecy in heaven? Because all will be made known. And when we make miracles, wonders, and signs the focus, and that becomes the interest of our life, when we get to heaven, we're going to be very disappointed. There isn't going to be any of that. There's going to be Jesus. So I'm not saying that those things are bad or wrong. Actually, what miracles are, why they exist, is because we live in a broken world. When we don't live in a broken world, there won't be miracles, wonders, and signs. So what I'm saying is the church, it's so easy to get focused on the wrong thing. The enemy will get us distracted on something that's it's almost the focus. It almost should be the focus, but it's not. Jesus is our singular focus. There's a phrase, I believe very much in holiness. I am a holiness preacher. I believe in the optimistic view that when God works in your life, it works. And boy, does it work. But I always want to encourage the focus is not holiness. Jesus is our focus, and he is the one who makes us holy. It's a focus thing. I think the same way when it comes to like evangelism and witnessing to people. I remember there were years where I felt so much pressure that when I would go to a place that I had to fix everybody's problems. I have plenty of problems. We all have plenty of problems, right? And I just thought like, and all the pressure that started putting on the people who were not Christians, didn't know Jesus, if I could just preach the right sermon the right way, they would come to know Jesus. I had all this pressure on me until finally the Lord told me, stop convincing people to love Jesus and just convince them that you do. And all that pressure came off. What if what it meant to reach other people was to walk with him? Do you realize people in our world, they're looking at you, they're asking this question, does holiness work? Does Jesus work? Is it real? They're looking at you, and you can tell them that it works all you want, but that what they really care about is whether it works in you. So instead of convincing people to love Jesus, convince them that you do, because they want to know if it works. And boy, does it work. Fix our eyes on Jesus. He is the pioneer and the perfecter of our faith. It's one single message. It's one focus. And all of these other things, as important as they are, they're not the focus. Would you join me in fixing our eyes on Jesus this week? I think for our morning service, you know, the altars are always open, even if I don't do a formal altar call. But when Tab comes, can we just take a moment while he's singing, as we're worshiping, to fix our eyes on Jesus, make him the pioneer and the perfecter of our faith. And if in this last year you have sensed that you have become distracted by something else, even if it's a good thing, would you be willing to redirect your focus on him and say, Jesus, I'm fixing my eyes on you today. Jesus, I want to fix my eyes on you. In whatever way I've been distracted this year, in these recent months, even if they are good things, even if they're the business of the church, which is good and needed and wonderful, I don't want to miss you in the midst of it. Jesus, what if you're the miracle? Maybe my whole life I've been looking for miracles in my life, and I never realized you were right there in front of me. And so, Jesus, I fix my eyes on you today. As we worship, as we sing, help us to fix our eyes on you. We pray this in your name.